It's Black History Month. And I mean, I don't know how to feel about it. I mean, on one hand, literally singling out one group of people based on their skin color classifies them as a different, like, group of people rather than just continuing this idea of, you know, we're all the same, or, you know, whatever progressive crap people are trying to believe. But, you know, on the other hand, Black History Month is a really good way to make racist people just see how great black people are. And I mean, look, if we have to segregate their history for a month to do it, that's just the price that we're going to have to pay. But you know what? This isn't a philosophical show. This isn't a debate about sociological issues. It's our weird world.
Our weird world.
Welcome to Our Weird World. I'm your host, John Henson, and this week we are celebrating Black History Month the only way we know how, by highlighting some lesser known and undeniably not so great moments from Black history. Now, I know what you're thinking. Highlighting less than desirable moments in Black history is not exactly in line with the spirit of Black History Month. And to that I say, yeah, no duh. You're not wrong. But, you know, that's just kind of how things roll around here. And so we're going to look at five different stories that understandably have never made it into the traditional, you know, the more you know segments of Black History Month. We're going to look at Joyce Heth and Zip the Pinhead, two early, very racist circus acts, if we're being honest. We'll also look at the life of Henry Box Brown, the MOVE organization, and then lastly, Colin Ferguson. So strap in, get ready to be offended and guilty, you know, for being white. It's story time. We'll start with Joyce Heth, who was a slave held by John S. Bowling in Louisville, Kentucky. And because slaves weren't really considered real people, no one really knows much about Joyce's early life. So really, this story starts in 1835 when Joyce was sold to R.W. Lindsay and Coley Bartram, who were two traveling promoters. Lindsay began advertising Joyce as being the former childhood nurse of George Washington back in the 1730s. Now, if you didn't immediately do the math on that, Lindsay was talking about something that happened 100 years prior. And when people either didn't believe Lindsay or really particularly care for a 100-plus-year-old woman who had allegedly seen George Washington as a child, Lindsay then sold Joyce to P.T. Barnum. Obviously, the Barnum and Bailey Circus, like probably the most famous circus of all time. And Barnum quickly billed Joyce as, quote, the most astonishing and interesting curiosity in the world, which, I mean, look, I don't know what's going on in the 1830s, but if a 100-year-old woman is the most astonishing and interesting curiosity in the world, like that sounds like a boring place, you know? And like, I get it. I mean, like the life expectancy of a woman in the 1830s was like, I don't know what, like 20 years. I mean, because at that point, I mean, you're married at like 15, and then by 20 you've already had like 8 kids. I don't think the math lines up on that, but I mean it's the gist of how it goes. Barnum claimed that Joyce was owned by Augustine Washington, who was George's father, and that Joyce was the first person to ever put clothes on the future first president because, and honestly, he just said that because Barnum didn't really bother verifying the things that Lindsay had told him. Barnum just was like, oh, really? She was George Washington's nurse? Cool, let me have her. I'll buy her. I will buy this human being and exploit this. Barnum, you know, randomly recorded Joyce's birth as occurring in 1674, which at the time would have then made her 161 years old. And because Barnum was such a great showman, people believed him. And it also helped that Joyce pretty much already had one foot in the grave at this point. She was blind, almost entirely paralyzed, with the exception of being able to slightly move her right arm. And so for the next 7 months, Joyce got, you know, was kind of, I guess, wheeled out in front of crowds and told stories about, quote, little George, and then sang hymns for people. Joyce's exhibit alone earned Barnum $1,500 every week, which is comparable to about $42,000. So now, obviously, there were people who doubted it. You know, Barnum, and so Barnum promised that upon Joyce's death, he would hold a public autopsy because certainly Joyce didn't deserve a proper and respectable burial or anything. You know, why would she? She was black. These are not my beliefs. These are, you know, signs of the times. So Joyce did end up dying the following year, and Barnum followed through with his promise. He charged 50 cents admission to the public autopsy and brought in Dr. David L. Rogers, a respected surgeon, to perform the autopsy. So on February 25th, 1836, I think, 1,500 people crammed inside the city saloon in New York City. And Rogers, who apparently didn't get the memo to play along, declared Barnum's age claim as fraud. And, you know, it's like, which, I mean, obviously, you know, I mean, you probably wouldn't take a genius to look at, you know, anyone and be like, no, there's no way she's 161 years old. You're an idiot. She's like half that age. Barnum quickly asserted that Joyce then wasn't actually dead and was actually on a tour in Europe, and that some trickster must have just swapped the bodies. You know, it's a big joke. And that actually apparently appeased the crowd, who just forgot all about it and moved on. And, you know, and Barnum went on for, you know, to more circus success. So next up is the story of Henry Brown, who was born in 1816 on a plantation in Northern Virginia. He grew up as a slave and worked in a tobacco factory in Richmond. And then as an adult, he was married to another slave named Nancy, and the couple ended up having three children together. However, because slave marriage wasn't recognized by the slave owners, you know, and even though Brown paid his master not to sell his family, his wife and his kids were sold off to another slave owner anyway. And not surprisingly, that was kind of the last straw, you know, for Henry, who was just sick of the mistreatment from his master. And so he began coming up with a plan to escape to a free state. But instead of just using his superior athleticism and running for it, like most slaves did, which honestly, like, how was this not more of a thing? Like, look, this is not a racist statement. This is a fact. Like, black people are just superior athletes to white people. And like the fact that more of them did not just start running, you know, like, look, here's another non-racist statement. I feel like I have to say that because I'm white, but like, who are the best long distance runners in the Olympics? The African teams. And where did the slaves come from? Africa. So, you know, I don't understand how more of them didn't just start running. Because A, they're going to be faster than the white guy, and they can run farther than the white guy. Like, they could have all just run away, and no one would have ever caught them. So, I don't know. It's weird. I seriously don't know how slavery lasted as long as it did. But anyway, instead, rather than running away, Henry decided that his best option was to cram himself in a box and then mail himself to a new city. So with the help of James Smith, a free black man, and Samuel Smith, a sympathetic white shoemaker, Brown arranged a delivery with the Adams Express Company, which was one of the early like forms of like FedEx or UPS. Brown took half of the $166 he had saved and gave it to Samuel, who then went to Philadelphia to organize the delivery with members of the Pennsylvania Anti-Slavery Society. After meeting with three abolitionists, Samuel then returned to Richmond and marked a large box with the address for Passmore Williamson, who was a Quaker merchant in Philadelphia. And then on March 29th, on March 29th, Brown launched his plan here. So first, he had to figure out how to get out of work at the tobacco factory in Richmond. But again, rather than just running for his life, because that would have been so much easier, he took sulfuric acid and actually burned his hand down to the bone. And although it was incredibly painful, it got him out of work and he was sent home for the day. Probably just for the day. So it's like, yeah, you know, sleep it off, come back tomorrow. But instead of going back to the plantation, Brown met Samuel, who then stuffed him inside a 3x2 foot box labeled dry goods. Ironic, I guess. With just a little bit of water and a few biscuits for the ride to Philadelphia, the box was nailed shut. They cut a small hole for air, and then an additional handle with care and this side up labels were placed on the box. But you know, the longstanding tradition of mail carriers ignoring those fragile or, you know, handle with care labels was already in place. And Brown's box was dumped upside down and tossed around as he was transported by wagon, train, boat, wagon again, train again, boat again, train again, and then finally on a delivery wagon over the next 27 hours as he went from Richmond to Philadelphia. And as, you know, once he was delivered and Passmore opened the box, Brown jumped out and was just like, "How do you do, gentlemen?" That's like a literal quote. I didn't just come up with that. That would be kind of lame if I did. So with his freedom secured, Brown ended up becoming a public speaker, telling the world how he had escaped slavery. Brown's speeches actually ended up irritating Frederick Douglass, which is probably one of the names you hear about a lot for Black History Month, because Douglass hoped other slaves wouldn't use Brown's techniques to escape, but he was hoping that other slaves would use Brown's techniques to escape, but because Brown was touring and telling people about what he did, white people actually became more wary of their slaves using the mail to escape, and so they kind of cracked down on that, and fewer slaves were actually allowed to escape. A few weeks after Brown, escaped Virginia, a slave owner contacted him and asked if he wanted to purchase his family back. And Brown worked for the next 8 months to save up enough money to buy his family back. And then finally, with the help of other anti-slavery charities, Brown purchased not only his wife and children, but all of his other extended family members from various plantations around Virginia. I'm just kidding, actually. He actually rejected the offer, moved to England, and married a white woman. I'm not even making that up. He then spent the next 25 years as part of a traveling show telling his slavery story to British audiences. And then after the Civil War, he returned to America with his new family and performed as a magician. And Brown eventually died in Toronto on June 15th, 1897. I just found that so funny that, like, he had the opportunity to buy his family back and he was just like, "Nah, fam, I'm going to go to England and get me a white woman." I don't know. But anyway, the next story here is of Zip the Pinhead, whose real name was William Henry Johnson. And he was born to a poor black family of former slaves in 1857 in Bound Brook, New Jersey. And although his face and the rest of his body grew to a normal size, his head didn't. Basically, what happened was, you know, his face was normal size. Whoops, I hit the microphone with my hand. His face was a normal size, but then his head just kind of didn't grow, and it just kind of tapered off into oblivion, almost kind of made him look like a cone head. And many people thought that he suffered from microcephaly, which was a condition in which the brain never fully developed, leaving the recipient with a smaller head, mental deficiencies, and seizures. It's similar to the condition that the Zika babies were having a few years ago when we were all panicking about that, like back before like the world really got terrible. But outside of his oddly shaped head, Zip was a normal functioning person. And when agents from the nearby Van Imburg Circus in Somerville, New Jersey, saw Zip, they negotiated a deal with his parents to display him in their circus in exchange for money. And Zip was advertised as, and this is where it gets kind of racist, Zip was advertised as the missing link between apes and humans after his capture in Africa, which, I mean, like I said, like, this would be considered so racist today that middle-aged white women, all the Karens who feel the need to speak with a manager about everything, like, would just have a stroke and just lose their mind. Like, their brains would just melt out of their nose. Like, at just how racist that is. But Zip ended up being a hit at the circus. You know, he was eventually purchased by P.T. Barnum, given a furry suit to wear, and had his hair styled like Alfalfa from The Little Rascals, which really accentuated his odd-shaped head. Barnum expanded on Zip's African missing link story and claimed that he only ate raw meat, nuts, and fruit, but was in the process of eating, quote, more civilized food, like bread. Yeah, just because. During the show, Zip would scream and rattle his cage, and although as time went on, he did become, you know, a little more civil about it. He eventually joined the stage with other freak show performers like Jack Earl, who at 8'6" was billed as the tallest man in the world, and Cuckoo the Bird Girl, who was a woman from Georgia who suffered from Vertigo-Seckel syndrome, which is a disorder that left her bald, toothless, nearly blind, and with facial features that kind of loosely resembled that of a bird. Like, she was, I mean, look, to put it bluntly, she was a hideous-looking person. Zip went on to use some of the money he earned performing to purchase a fiddle that he claimed once belonged to Daniel Boone. Don't know if that's true, but that's what he believed. Although he couldn't play the instrument to save his life, audiences thought it was super adorable whenever he tried to. In 1925, actually, Zip saved a girl drowning in the ocean near Coney Island while working in New York at the New Amsterdam Theater for the play Sunny. Although Zip ended up dying from bronchitis a year later, having performed for over 100 million people, he died from bronchitis a year later, having performed for over 100 million people between his carnival acts and also in the stage productions that he was a part of later. So that was actually more of an uplifting Black History Month story. Zip should probably be featured a lot more. Some of the others, probably not. Like, for example, our next story, which is about the organization MOVE. And MOVE, M-O-V-E, which actually doesn't even stand for anything, was founded in 1972 by a man named John Africa as a communal group which followed the anarcho-primitivism school of thought. And Africa named the group MOVE because, according to him, that's what they were going to do. It was weird. They're just going to move. Where? Who knows? Just wherever. Also, anarcho-primitivists believe in a non-civilized way of life and would prefer it if we all just went back to behaving like animals and cavemen. MOVE's members wore their hair in dreadlocks, promoted a hunter-gatherer society, and openly rejected medicine and technology, which... All of which seems really difficult to do when you live in the middle of one of the largest cities in the country, which was Philadelphia. To make things confusing for everyone, all of the members changed their last name to Africa to honor what they considered their mother continent. And after several complaints from people in the neighborhood where they lived, the Philadelphia mayor Frank Rizzo finally obtained a court order to evict MOVE from a home they occupied on the western side of the city. And they agreed to the condition and to even surrender their weapons as long as police released various MOVE members who were already currently being held in jail. So police, who were acting in good faith, released the prisoners. But once they were out, MOVE threw up a giant middle finger and decided to just stay in the house anyway. And over the next year, MOVE and the police continued negotiations, but after a year, the police finally showed up to forcefully evict the group, which I can't even believe it took them that long. And when police walked in, MOVE members started shooting, which seems odd considering a primitive lifestyle shouldn't allow for the use of something so technologically advanced as a gun, but whatever. One Philadelphia police officer was killed, and 9 MOVE members were charged with his death. And those 9 members were charged with third-degree murder and given 100-year sentences. Following the shootout with police, MOVE relocated to another neighborhood in West Philadelphia, born and raised on the playgrounds where they spent most of their days. Sorry. You probably started singing that in your head once I said West Philadelphia. So don't judge me. And they immediately began annoying their new neighbors with all of the trash they left around their building, as well as the obscene political messages they shouted through their bullhorns, which, again, why do you have a bullhorn if you are against technology? Anyway, in 1985, police obtained more arrest warrants, this time for violating parole, contempt of court, illegal possession of firearms, and making terroristic threats. New Mayor Wilson Good went so far as to officially label MOVE as a terrorist organization and ordered residents in the neighborhood to evacuate just in case something bad happened. And something bad would absolutely happen. On May 13th, 1985, City Manager Leo Brooks arrived with 500 police officers in an attempt to execute the arrest warrants and get MOVE out of their building. The police shut off the water and electricity, and then Police Commissioner Gregor Sambor read a speech out loud that he had prepared, I guess trying to motivate them to cooperate. And when that didn't work, police decided to use force. And things escalated very quickly. Within minutes, police and members of MOVE were in the middle of like this A-team style shootout where each side was firing semi-automatic and automatic weapons at each other at relatively close range, and yet no one died, but a lot of stuff blew up and there was a bunch of damage everywhere. If you ever watched any episode of the A-Team, like that's always what happened, is like there's just like everyone's firing machine guns at each other at just preposterously close range. No one ever dies. Maybe someone gets like nicked and then they get arrested later, but like no one ever dies, but like a bunch of stuff blows up. After police fired more than 10,000 rounds, Commissioner Sanborn decided that he was going to just end everything. Like, we're not going to do this anymore. He called the Pennsylvania State Police and had them strap two bombs to a helicopter, which I guess was a reasonable request to make in the mid-80s. The chopper quickly arrived on the scene and actually dropped the bombs, which ignited a gas-powered generator, which, you know, the generator was belonged to MOVE. Again, something that people who shun technology shouldn't be using. And unsurprisingly, the entire neighborhood went up in flames, which is obviously what happens when you drop bombs on a neighborhood. In all, 65 homes in that West Philadelphia neighborhood were destroyed, and 11 MOVE members, including founder John Africa, died in the conflict. No one from the Philadelphia city government was criminally charged in the event, but instead they were just kind of scolded for making, you know, poor decisions. Ramona Africa, the only surviving MOVE member from the attack, was charged with conspiracy and inciting a riot and served 7 years in prison. So there you go. Our last story here is about Colin Ferguson, who was born on January 14th, 1958, to a wealthy family in Kingston, Jamaica. He graduated from high school in the top third of his class, and everyone thought he was just a generally great person. But shortly after graduation, Ferguson's father died in a car accident, and then his mother died of cancer shortly thereafter, and he was immediately left with nothing. He moved to the United States in 1982 in hopes of starting over. But unfortunately, Ferguson just found a lot of racist people in New York City. Shocking. Despite his intellect, he failed to really find any sort of job outside of basic minimum wage manual labor positions. He did manage to get married in 1986 and moved with his new wife to a house on Long Island, but the relationship was volatile and police were often called to the home to break up fights between the two, and the couple divorced 2 years later, citing different social views as the reason for divorce, and that will be a very important detail later on here. To make things worse, Ferguson had recently slipped and fallen at his job, injuring his head, neck, and back. And the injury ultimately cost him his job, and despite filing a complaint, it took several years for the case to move forward. In the meantime, Ferguson tried to start over again and enrolled at Nassau Community College, where he made the dean's list 3 times. However, he was kicked out after he acted aggressively towards one professor, like during a class or something. He then transferred to Adelphi University in Garden City and enrolled in business administration courses. While there, he spent his free time speaking out against racism and accusing white people of acting racist toward him. And this is kind of where it gets a little, you know, starts to go downhill. He even attended a symposium conducted by a professor who discussed her experience in South Africa, most of which centered around race relations. And during the seminar, Colin Ferguson, you know, decided it was a great time to speak up. And he said, you know, we should be talking about the revolution in South Africa and how we get rid of the white people. Kill everybody white. That's what he said. I don't know if he sounded exactly like that. That's just the voice that I've given him in my head. Obviously, Colin was suspended for those remarks. And so he moved to Brooklyn, where people quickly noticed that he was just constantly blaming white people for all of his troubles in life. In February 1992, he was arrested for harassing a woman on a subway after she had kindly asked him to move over so she could sit down. Despite sending several letters to the New York City Police Commissioner claiming that officers had been too rough with him during his arrest, those allegations were quickly dismissed. Later that year, in 1992, Ferguson finally received $26,250 for his workers' compensation claim from back when he had fallen, like before he ever enrolled at Nassau Community College. But rather than taking that money, Ferguson demanded that his case be reopened so he could get more money. He tried to hire a lawyer, but quickly came to believe that they were discriminating against him for whatever reason. His appeal was rejected, and he was placed on a dangerous persons list by the New York State Workers' Compensation Board, which is smart. Putting people on lists. It's what we got to do more of. Probably. I don't know. I'm probably on a list for all this stuff that I've researched. In April 1993, Ferguson decided to move to California to try to start over yet again. After a manager at a car wash where Ferguson was briefly employed laughed at him for some unknown reason, probably because he was funny, you know, just anyone who just walks around like blaming white people and saying, kill all the white people, like you either have to laugh at that or, you know, get far away. So after his employer or after his manager laughed at him, Ferguson went out and bought a Ruger P89 pistol. And you know, but rather than kill his boss, which you were probably expecting me to say right then, Colin actually just decided to move back to New York because he didn't like competing with immigrants and Hispanics for jobs in California. That's exactly what he said. You know, he moved back to New York because he didn't want to compete with immigrants and Hispanics for jobs, proving that he clearly didn't know anything about New York, because outside of California, if you're going to be competing with immigrants and Hispanics for jobs, it's going to be in New York City. He also started referring to himself in third person and rambling about an apocalyptic scenario in which all of the black people killed all of the white people. So, you know, look, anytime people start referring to themselves in third person all the time, like, it's weird enough, but then you start talking about how, you know, oh, all the black people are going to rise, all whiteys are going to be killed, it's going to be a great day. Yeah, like at that point, his landlord got really concerned and asked him to move out of the building that he lived in. On December 7th, Ferguson bought a ticket for the Long Island Railroad in Brooklyn. And as the train approached the Maryland Avenue station, Ferguson took out his gun from his bag and stood up. And upon standing, several cartridges dropped from the bag. And at that point, Ferguson freaked out and started firing at random, moving down the train car, pulling the trigger as often as the gun would let him, and shouting, "I'm going to get you," at each person he shot. Over the next 3 minutes, Ferguson killed 6 people and injured 19 more. Several passengers mistook the sound of gunshots for fireworks, which I guess isn't surprising considering, you know, the New York commuter rail system. Other passengers were just audibly annoyed by the screaming and terror coming from the adjacent cars, which also not surprising coming from the New York commuter rail system. You know, it's just like, I've been on like New York subway trains, and it's just like a packed car. Everyone's just annoyed with how crammed it is. And then you hear just like popping going on and screaming in the next car over. And you're just like, God, I hate everyone. Not even thinking that people are just actively being shot to death. After Ferguson had emptied 2 15-round magazines, someone finally had the idea to pounce on him and take him down. And 3 men, Kevin Blum, Mark McEntee, and Michael O'Connor, all brought Ferguson to the ground and pinned him against the seats. After he'd been subdued, Ferguson's whole tone changed. He kind of just started freaking out. You know, he was just like, "Oh God, what did I do? I deserve whatever happens to me. Just please don't shoot me. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry." After several minutes, an off-duty officer boarded the train, saw what was going on, and handcuffed Ferguson. So on January 14th, the following year, a grand jury produced a 93-count indictment against Ferguson that carried as many as 175 years in prison. The trial became a gigantic media circus as various lawyers with zero moral qualms whatsoever offered to defend him pro bono for free. Like, that's what I don't understand really about like criminal defense attorneys. Like, you have a guy who very obviously shot and killed a bunch of people on a subway train, and you are going to for free defend him in court. Like, you're just as bad. Like, I can see if, you know, maybe there's some evidence to suggest that maybe he didn't do it, and that's the guy you defend. Totally on board with that. All right. You know, defend people who have been wrongfully accused. Totally. But when you have someone who shot a bunch of people, everyone saw him do it, and then you're going to be like, "Nah, I'm going to defend this guy. He's a good guy. Like, don't worry about it." Like, we should have a rule in this country that, like, in cases like that, like, the attorney who defends the guy should get the same sentence as the guy who did the shooting. That would be great. I would love to live in that country. Anyway, as soon as Ferguson spent time, entered jail, he immediately began complaining, mainly because people kept attacking him for various things, including one incident that left him with a broken nose. However, Ferguson's attorneys, William Kunstler, That's swear to God's his name. William Kunstler and Ron Cuby, also known as the most morally devoid people on the planet at the time, finally came up with Ferguson's true defense. They claimed that Ferguson had been driven to insanity by what they called black rage, which was a condition that was first made up in 1967 by two other psychologists. Kunstler and Cuby argued that black rage was akin to PTSD, battered woman syndrome, and child abuse syndrome, all of which had been used in the past to get violent offenders a lesser sentence or acquitted entirely. And at that point, Ferguson actually started claiming that he hadn't been a part of the shootings at all and insisted that he had received messages from God. So now he's clearly insane. On August 20th, Ferguson rejected his lawyer's efforts to have him declared mentally unfit for trial and went on a long, nonsensical rant about how awful white people were. Eventually, even Kunstler and Kuby couldn't even defend Ferguson, who himself couldn't even figure out if he was insane or not. He just kept switching back and forth. He kept, you know, making different claims about what actually happened. Then he got like super, super conspiratorial with it. Ferguson started to argue that the 93 counts against him were suspiciously coincidental to the year the shooting occurred, which was 1993, and that if he had perpetrated the shooting in a different year, he would have received a corresponding number of charges. In other words, so like if he had committed the shooting in 1986, he only would have received 86 charges, which was really stupid. Just no logic to that whatsoever. He did admit that he had brought the gun onto the train, but claimed that another man took it from him while he was asleep and did all the shooting. He also began talking about a man named Mr. Sue, who definitely wasn't real, but was conspiring against him. Ferguson actually somehow convinced another person to testify that the government had inserted a chip into Ferguson's brain, which then turned out to be a remote control device that forced Ferguson to carry out the attack. He even tried to call President Bill Clinton to the stand during the trial, but obviously none of it worked. And probably the only reason that a lot of people don't know more about Colin Ferguson's trial was because it was going on during the O.J. Simpson trial, which was, you know, more of a media circus. One other thing before we wrap up here, between bizarre episodes of Ferguson's trial, he actually got into a fight with another serial killer named Joel Rifkin. We might do an episode on him later down the road, but Joel Rifkin was just a standard run-of-the-mill serial killer. I mean, he killed some women and buried their bodies. And it all started when Ferguson told Rifkin to be quiet so Ferguson could have a phone conversation. And he's like, "I wiped out six devils. You only kill women." And Rifkin was like, "Yeah, but I killed more people than you." And at that point, Ferguson was like, "Oh, no, you didn't, white boy." And then the brawl was on. And I don't know who won. I don't know who wins in a prison fight unless, you know, someone dies. But whatever. On February 17th, 1995, Ferguson was convicted of the murders of the six people he had killed on the subway and for attempting to kill the 19 he injured. He was sentenced to 315 years to life in prison, which I do not understand that either. Like, just give someone life in prison. Don't give them, you know, a minimum sentence that is going to be way longer than anyone has ever lived. You know, it's just like, the court finds you guilty and will now sentence you to 315 years to life in prison on the off chance that scientific technology advances to the point where humans become immortal or at least quadruples their expected lifespan. Like, no, that doesn't happen, but whatever. None of this story makes sense. But finally, we are done with story time. Happy Black History Month, everybody. So now, instead of always hearing about George Washington Carver or Jackie Robinson or whoever, now you know some lesser-known black history stories, and, you know, maybe you wish you didn't, but, you know, maybe you're more conflicted about race relations, but it's not my problem. I'm just here to tell stories, make bad jokes. So let's see what we learned this week.
What did we learn?
Number one, circuses, along with being cruel to animals and just generally weird and boring, are also super racist. Number two, hey, if you're a member of the police, don't ever, ever drop bombs on the town you're supposed to be protecting, no matter how much the people actually deserve it. And number three, white people. If you're white and you're listening to this, just, you know, be nice to black people. I mean, sure, their skin color is different, but that doesn't make them any lesser or inferior to you. If you're going to treat someone poorly, don't do it because the color of their skin is different. Do it because they're just legitimately a terrible person. Next week on Our Weird World, we are going to continue our Black History Month celebration with even more terrible stories about black people. Yay! No, I'm just kidding. We're not going to do that. Next week, I don't know why I had to make it like that. That was weird. Next week, we are going to cover the story of Richard Kuklinski, a mafia hitman known as the Iceman, for just how just ruthless he was when he made his killings. One of the most prolific serial killers in American history. It's going to be a great story. Just really brutal. A lot of cringy moments in that. So thank you all for listening. Hopefully you're not too butthurt. If you're black, don't hate me. You know, this whole, you know what? Yeah. Go back and listen to the other episodes. Like, it's all bad white people, you know. Let's be honest. There's going to be bad Hispanics. All right. We've had bad Japanese people. All right. It was black people's turn. All right. So just calm down over there. All right. Thanks for listening. Tell all your friends. Keep it weird.